The Navigators is an international, interdenominational Christian organization whose objective is to help fulfill Christ's commission to make disciples of all nations. They individually teach the basics of the Christian life to new believers, who then teach others. They work on campuses, military bases, and among lay men and women on every continent.
Tonight we want to talk about three subjects. We want to give some further thoughts on the subject of love as it relates to the entire relationship, not just the husband's role, as we looked at it today, but rather the entire gamut of scriptural truth regarding love, how it applies to all of us. Then secondly, we want to talk for a period of time about the differences between men and women, just to expose our thinking a bit to some of these unique qualities. And finally, how to resolve conflicts. So, let's start out with love. We've seen already that one of the primary passages from which we get guidelines regarding love is 1 Corinthians 13, 4 through 7. And you recall in one of the sessions regarding the responsibility of the husband, we gave 9 words that paraphrase the words that we have in the various versions, the qualities that demonstrate, that depict love. We will not repeat them at this time, but I encourage you to review those. Other passages which speak to us very clearly about this responsibility are John 13, 34 and 35, and Ephesians 4, 1 through 3. Now, it's the Ephesians passage that we want to concentrate on tonight. And so I would encourage you to open your Bibles, if you will, and we will look at that passage and seek to get some guidelines that will help us understand what is involved in this quality of love which is to be depicted among us and which Jesus said was so important that he said in that passage in John 13, "By this shall all men know that you are my disciples, if you have love one for another." Jesus placed that quality at that extremity of importance. Men and women will observe that we are disciples of Jesus Christ not simply because we are so dedicated, not simply because we are so willing to serve Him, but more than anything, because of this quality of love in its multitude of expressions among us in our interpersonal relationships. Now, I'm sure if we had an opportunity, there would be many testimonies regarding this very fact. I can recall a number of people who have said to me how impressed they have been as they have been with a group in which this was evidenced. And what they were impressed with was not the quality of their dedication, but the quality of the love that they sensed in the interpersonal relationships. And so from this passage in Ephesians 4, let's see what we can learn. "Therefore, I, as a prisoner for the Lord," this is Paul writing, Paul the Apostle, "beg you to lead a life worthy of the calling to which you have been called." And then he tells us how we're to do this. "With all lowliness and meekness, with patience, forbearing one another in love, eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace." Now, in this passage, there are 4 qualities which are expressed, and these are extremely important. And I want briefly to help us try to understand them. Now, remember what our definition of love is. We're going to repeat this through the seminar. We said that we're using the working definition, which says that love is an unselfish concern that freely accepts another and seeks his good. Unselfish concern, accepts, and seeks the good of the other person. Let's start with the word lowliness. lowliness, which could be identified in another quality and quantity, or another word, as humility. These are synonymous, lowliness and humility. Philippians 2, 3, and 4 is a passage with which a number of us are familiar, where it talks about looking not to our own things, but to the things of others. Be of the same mind, having the same love, being in full accord, verse 2. Then 3, do nothing from selfishness or conceit, but in humility, count others better than yourself. Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. Humility. We mentioned in another session the passage in 1 Peter 5, verses 5 and 6. Verse 6 says, humble yourself under the hand of God. Verse 5 says, humble yourself to one another. Putting it into a very practical perspective. Humble yourself to one another. We are all familiar with Matthew 11, 28 and 29. These are passages that are used a great deal. Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly of heart, and you shall find rest unto your souls. I suggest to you that there are two relationships suggested in that passage. The first one being the initial relationship when a person comes to the knowledge of Jesus Christ and commits their life to Him. Come, you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. That's the initial rest. Rest from the guilt of sin. Rest from the frustration of life without Jesus Christ. Rest from all of the things we looked at this morning that Jesus Christ came to do in Isaiah 61:1. That's the initial relationship. But in verse 29, it seems to me he's talking of something different. This is the person who now knows him. And he invites us to take his yoke upon us and learn of him. And what is it he wants to learn, or wants us to learn? I am meek, lowly of heart. And what is the product? You shall find rest for your soul. Inner rest. Now, why is that true? Well, in interpersonal relationships, when I am willing to express this quality of lowliness or humility toward my fellow man, whoever he might be, when I am willing to express this quality toward another individual, I immediately eliminate the stress of competitiveness. The stress of comparison. I'm willing to humble myself. I'm not trying to claim anything for myself. I'm not trying to demand rights for myself. I am putting their interests ahead of mine, according to Philippians 2, 3, and 4. Therefore, there's no competition. There's no struggle for supremacy. And there's a quietness that comes into my life as I'm willing to operate on that basis. The stress of comparison and the stress of competition. I mentioned this morning one of the things that I've encountered, an actual fact, where men are often fearful of their wives because in some areas our wives demonstrate and display qualities and capacities which we do not have. And rather than accept that and use those qualities, some men are threatened by these. Now, why are they threatened? Primarily because of a lack of lowliness, a lack of humility. My wife has qualities in her life that I recognize and appreciate very, very much that I do not have. But that's why the Lord put us together. That's why the Lord put you together. Because there is always the ministry of complementation, where I am able to support her in areas where she may need support, and she is able to support me in areas where I know I need support. Now, if I'm willing to accept that, if I'm willing to demonstrate an attitude of lowliness, then there isn't going to be a spirit of competition or feeling threatened by the strengths of another person. Lowliness. The second word that's used is meekness. There has been a great deal of misunderstanding regarding meekness, simply because it's misused by the world around us. A meek man is depicted as a Mr. Milquetoast, the little man that doesn't do or say anything. Timid. And there's where the difficulty arises. Timidity and meekness in the heart or in the minds of many people are synonymous. And that is not true. That is, in fact, the very opposite of what is true. A meek man is anything but timid. A meek man, in fact, or a meek person, is a person who has arrived at a sense of inner security and strength, which allows them to operate in a situation without insisting on getting their way. Therefore, I suggest to you a brief definition of meekness is simply an unwillingness to retaliate, even when possible or justifiable. An unwillingness to retaliate, even when possible or justifiable. Someone else has said that meekness is strength under control, and that is certainly true. Because here is a person who, by virtue of the strength that they have at their command to retaliate in some way, or to justify themselves, or to demand their rights, chooses instead not to do that for the benefit of everyone involved. I suggest to you 1 Peter 2:21 through 23 as the key passage to depict what it is I'm trying to express. We have here the story or the incident that the Apostle Peter writes to us to assist us in understanding what this quality is. Beginning with verse 21, "For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. He committed no sin." Now listen to this carefully. "He committed no sin. He was faultless. No guile was found on his lips. He was blameless. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, though he could have, couldn't he? When he was reviled, he could have retaliated very properly. No one could accuse him, and yet he accepted the accusation without defending himself. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. And when he suffered, he did not threaten. And the key, he trusted to him who judges justly." There is the key to a meek spirit. My concept of God will determine whether or not I'm willing to operate on the basis of meekness. And if I'm not certain that God is going to defend me, then I'm going to try to defend myself. If I'm not certain that God is going to judge justly, then I'm going to fight for my rights. If I can't trust God with my life and reputation, then I'm going to defend it. And so my concept of God comes to play very, very much in this matter of whether or not I'm willing to demonstrate an attitude of meekness. Someone has said, "But George, doesn't that imply a loss of your own self-image? You're just giving yourself away. You're not allowing yourself to have a strong self-image." Oh, no. On the contrary, the very fact that I do have a strong self-image, or if you please, an inner personal security about myself, allows me to operate without retaliating, even when I have a right to. You see, the stronger a person is inside, the stronger they are regarding themselves, the more secure they are regarding their image, the more confident they are regarding their acceptance before God, the easier it is to give these rights away temporarily, knowing that I trust Him who judges justly. It's all going to come out right in His program. With all lowliness and meekness. Now remember this morning we said that love must be demonstrated in action. Here are actions. An attitude of lowliness or humility. An attitude of meekness. Not only that, the third thing. Patience. That's the third word that's used in this passage. Patience. We've seen already that patience is a basic quality of love. From 1 Corinthians 13:4. What it means is seeing people from God's point of view. Seeing people from God's point of view. God is certainly patient with us. God is long-suffering and working in our behalf in many ways. Remembering that we are both in constant change. I look at you and I remind myself, you are not what you're going to be. And I may see weaknesses and defects, just as you must in my life. But I hope that we can see each other with that quality of patience. We are in process. We are in movement. We are being developed. Romans 8:29 says, He is seeking to conform us to the image of His Son. This is something that's going on continually. And I hope when we meet one another again someday in the future, there will be development and growth in both of us. And by the grace of God, I anticipate that. If we could demonstrate that attitude toward one another, that's what patience is. Giving God time to do what He's begun. Giving God time to fulfill that plan that we talked about in Psalm 138:8. Being patient, not just with you, but being patient in waiting for God to do what He's at work doing in each one of us. Philippians 1:6, He who has begun a good work in you will continue to perform it until the day of Jesus Christ. And then finally, the fourth word is forbearance. Forbearance. I've looked this up and tried to find as good a definition as possible, and not many people have a great deal to say about this word. But the best I can come up with out of a number of sources that I've looked at is something like this. Making allowance for faults and weaknesses without judgment. Making allowance for faults and weaknesses without judgment. First of all, let's remember, this is a basic quality of God's character. God is the one who has demonstrated forbearance for us. Romans 2:4, or do you presume upon the riches of His kindness and forbearance and patience? His forbearance. And another passage that speaks of the same thing is 2 Peter 3:15, which you can jot down and look at later. 2 Peter 3:15. Talking about the forbearance of God. The idea of forbearance, as best I can get it, is anticipating in advance. Forbearing. Anticipating in advance to bear that person up with their weaknesses or with their faults. Recognizing that we all have them. In other words, not expecting a person to be more than they are. It's a basic quality of acceptance. Forbearance. And so I meet you and you look at me and you think, good night. He doesn't look anything like what I thought he was going to look like from the tapes I heard. You'd be surprised at the descriptions that people have given me about what they thought I looked like from the tapes. I'm glad that some of them were wrong. The point is, we look at one another anticipating that we all have weaknesses. And because I anticipate it, I'm willing and ready to seek to try to bear you up in love. This is what love is all about. Four qualities. Humility, lowliness, meekness, patience, forbearance. Now, The delightful result of this is unity. Did you notice that as we read that passage? Unity. And that's what we want. That's in that passage in Ephesians 4 that we read. Unity is the result. A oneness of heart. That's what we want in our families. That's what we want in our interpersonal relationships. As we demonstrate these qualities of love to one another, not just the husband, but every member of the body of Christ, the wife to the husband to the wife, the parents to the children to the parents, and all of us to one another. These are the qualities of love that I see in Scripture. Now let's talk about the matter of differences between men and women. The differences between male and female. You remember in Genesis 1:27 and 1:31, the passages we looked at earlier, he expresses the fact that when he created us male and female. And in verse 31, he looked back at that and said, it was very, very good. Now, before we look at these differences, I would like to ask you to jot down this brief statement of a prayer by Francis of Assisi. You may remember these words. They are in a larger context, but I took this one phrase, and it says this: Lord, grant that I may seek more to understand than to be understood. Lord, grant that I may seek more to understand than to be understood. Now, if we could hold that little prayer in our minds as we contemplate one another with our uniqueness and our differences, perhaps it would alleviate some of the stress of thinking, well, she should understand me, or he should understand me. But rather, how can I better understand him or her? And then from a book by Julius Fritzi, which I recommend to you very highly, called The Essence of Marriage. Primarily this chapter on the differences between men and women. Let me read just a couple of excerpts. A man is basically a logical, rational creature. A female is basically an emotional creature. A man is more active and more aggressive. He is more emotionally stable and well controlled about big things than is a woman. However, he is more irritable, excitable, impatient about small things. He is a vain, boastful exhibitionist. I didn't hear many men laugh at that. He is more optimistic than a woman and more businesslike. He is more ready to admit that he is mistaken. His logic demands it. I read that and I wonder if that's really true. But we'll accept Fritzi's statement. He is more objective and consistent, which is another evidence of logic. He is more able to concentrate on a consistent basis without his emotions getting in the way. A man is slower to mature, both physically and emotionally. However, a man, all things being equal, grows to a greater depth of maturity. A woman, being an emotional creature, is hindered in reaching this depth. The average man is likely to be more direct, truthful, sportsmanlike, and businesslike in communication with his fellow man. A man is more democratic in his dealings and is able to keep separate his business and personal relationships. May I add, sometimes too separate. A man ordinarily is less religious than a woman. May I add also, he may be less religious, but generally speaking, he is more devoted once he becomes committed to Christ. A man was made to love, a woman was made to be loved. A man does not need love. This is interesting, and I agree with this. A man does not need love, he needs respect. You see, when our wives respect us, it's the same thing as love. We don't need that same quality, the same quality of love that we think of is necessary for our wives. He needs respect. This he must earn. He will receive it if he is a dependable man. The little things count with a woman. A woman is a sensitive creature because she is an emotional being. Her sensitivity is necessary not only to compliment her husband, but also to be sensitive to her motherhood. Therefore, since marriage in its essence is an emotional relationship between a male and a female, and this emotion is love, the responsibility for the success or failure of a marriage weighs far heavier upon the man than it does upon the woman. Now, I give you these for your consideration, whether we all agree with everything he says or not. They are stimulating to our minds as we think about the differences between men and women. Man's biggest weakness is his pride. One of these statements we read says that men are primarily boastful and exhibitionists and sort of egotistical. And I think that's true. And this is one of the reasons why it's difficult for a man to admit that he's wrong, even when he's wrong. Especially if it's his wife that's pointing it out. There's just something about a man that reacts negatively to that whole concept. It is not right, but it happens to be true. That's part of the basic nature of a man's pride. But just as a man's weakness is pride, a woman's weakness is jealousy. She's always comparing herself. She's always wondering about areas that have to do with how you feel about her as regarding or with regards to your feelings about others. We said that a woman is more devotional, or more religious if you please, but a man is more devoted. He goes deeper in his relationship. Once a man gets motivated in this area, he tends to be much more deeply involved, less emotionally involved. Men are physically stronger, that is, as far as bones and muscle structure are concerned, but women are biologically stronger. There are far more male infant deaths than there are female infant deaths. Not only that, but at the other end of the spectrum, women outlive men by a large percentage. Biologically, a woman is stronger. A man, as we said earlier, matures more slowly, both physically and emotionally, than a woman does. Women want to be needed, to be understood, and to be wanted. I read an article by a woman regarding this, and she said, there is an emptiness, there is a loneliness in a woman that needs filling. Part of this is to be filled by the husband, but a warning is in place here. A warning is appropriate. Don't expect your husband to fill all of your needs. I have encountered certain situations where a woman feels that her husband is not meeting all her emotional needs. He's not supposed to. We can't. There are some needs that only God can meet. Don't ever forget that. We are limited as human beings. In the use of speech, women use speech to communicate feeling, while men use speech to communicate ideas. Men use speech to communicate ideas. And then there are differences between men and women that show up in the sexual relationship. All of these differences are very important to our relationships. Now, I cite them this evening only to call them to your attention. You are aware of a number of these, but I challenge you to take the time to read, to discuss, to communicate with one another, and to seek to learn more effectively what some of the major differences are between you and your mate, that you might better understand and better relate to one another. Now, finally, we want to talk about resolving conflicts. Resolving conflicts. Proverbs 13:10, only by pride comes contention. Or to paraphrase that from the living Psalms and Proverbs, pride leads to arguments. When there is a conflict that is unresolved, as we will explain in a moment, it's because of pride. Only by pride comes contention. Now, conflicts, we want to see first of all, conflicts are normal for development. Whether that development is an interpersonal relationship or a personal development. Conflicts go on all the time. I have to make choices regarding many areas of my life. I am in a state of conflict almost continually, particularly as a follower of Jesus Christ, because the Scriptures make demands of me, and my own flesh and myself make other demands, and I am constantly having to choose between the two. Conflict is not bad. Conflict is developmental. It can be very, very helpful. Now, the differences between a conflict and a problem are very important, and we want to examine these for a moment. There are four ways in which a conflict can be handled. In this demonstration which I am going to show you here, we will see the four ways in which conflicts can be handled. First of all, here is the conflict represented by this circle. The person or the persons having this conflict come up to it, go around it, and try to go on the other side. They come to the conflict, they go around it, and hope that they can continue to make progress without dealing with the conflict. Now, even though this illustration shows the arrow going on, the facts are, experience proves that what happens is you keep going around in circles, right around that unresolved conflict, because you're unwilling to face it. The second way conflicts can be handled is in this way. You come to the conflict, and instead of facing the conflict, you go off and deal with a peripheral issue, a side issue, not the real issue. And every time that conflict appears, you get involved in a side issue, and you never deal with the real situation. And so the conflict is never resolved. A third way in which you can deal with conflicts is to come up to them, turn around, and head the other way. And try to ignore them. Pretend they're not there. And of course, that doesn't work either. Unresolved conflicts will always reappear. And finally, the way in which Scripture tells us we can deal with conflicts is to come up to them and work our way right through them and make progress. Split the conflict by a willingness to deal with it, and then move right through and make progress. Four ways in which conflicts can be handled or dealt with. Now, a conflict, in order to explain it more clearly, is in an interpersonal relationship. A conflict is basically a difference of opinion. It may be a very strong difference of opinion, but basically it's a difference of opinion. Now, to solve this requires mutual effort and commitment to arrive at a mutually satisfactory conclusion. If we are unwilling to do that, we will find that that conflict will remain unresolved, and therefore will come back to cause real problems. And that is the difference between a conflict and a problem. A conflict, as we've explained, is a difference of opinion which needs to be dealt with. A problem is an area of experience in which a conflict has arisen and we are unwilling to face it. An unresolved conflict. Let me give you further illustration by way of these little demonstrations here. Conflict. A difference of opinion. two people discussing, quietly or vehemently, but discussing. Unresolved, that conflict becomes a problem. An unresolved conflict becomes a problem. But notice, that same problem, if dealt with, becomes a bridge to better communication by mutual effort. And finally, if two people are willing to do that, if two people are willing to make a mutual effort, then there is reconciliation. I want you to notice that word, reconciliation. It does not mean that the conflict is necessarily resolved as far as the issue is concerned. Please notice, Matthew 5, 22 and 23 talks about reconciliation. If you bring your gift to the altar and there you remember that your brother has something against you, go and be reconciled with your brother and then come and offer your gift at the altar. Now the difference between reconciliation and resolution is that reconciliation has to do with a relationship. Resolution has to do with the issue. You may not be able to resolve the issue completely. That is not necessary. There are some tensions that exist and continue to exist. Honest differences of opinion. But reconciliation is essential because that has to do with our relationship. Therefore, you deal with the relationship, not the issue. You deal with reconciliation, not resolution. You see, the goal of marriage is not for us to think alike, but to think together. The goal of marriage is unity, not uniformity. If it's going to be an insistence that we think exactly the same way and have exactly the same concepts and standards about everything, then we are unessential to one another. We need the differences of opinion, the differences of responses. But we also need a sense of reconciliation when there are differences. Conflicts that we are willing to resolve by virtue of reconciliation and arriving at a unity of spirit. Now, from Ephesians 4:15, some quick guidelines as to how we can accomplish this. In Ephesians 4:15, it says, "But speaking the truth in love, let us grow up in every way into Him who is the head, into Christ." Here they are, very quickly, three guidelines regarding speaking the truth to one another so that we don't create conflicts when we speak the truth with one another. One, in love. And we've talked about love enough already to know what we're talking about. Two, it should be edifying. Let us grow up in every way. That is, it should be constructive, edifying. And three, let us grow up in every way into Him who is the head, into Christ. It should produce Christ-likeness, both in the one who is expressing the truth as well as in the one who is receiving that truth. Love, edifying, and produce Christ-likeness. This is how we resolve or eliminate, avoid conflicts in sharing the truth with one another. What if a conflict does arise? Here are some scriptural guidelines. Ephesians 4:26. Don't let the sun go down on your wrath. A paraphrase of that says, don't sin by nursing a grudge. Now that means honesty and openness. That means communicating. That means keeping things out in the open. That means keeping short accounts with one another. Don't sin by nursing your grudge. Second, 1 John 1, 7 and 9. Claim forgiveness where you're wrong. Claim forgiveness where you're wrong. Now remember, we said Matthew 5, 23 and 24 says, if there is a conflict, you go and be reconciled. Matthew 18, 15 says, if your brother has done something to offend you, you go and tell him so. In both cases, don't forget, it is your move, my move. Whoever is responsible for the conflict is not the issue. We don't sit back and say, all right, he did that or she did that, therefore, well, wait till they come to me. No. In both cases, the Scripture says, it's my move. Matthew 5, 23 and 24, and Matthew 18, 15. We claim forgiveness, and then, according to Ephesians 4, 32, and Matthew 18, 21 and 22, we forgive and we forget. Oh, that's so important. So important. Forgive and forget. And then Ephesians 4:16, we seek to reconstruct the relationship. Ephesians 4:16. Quickly, four don'ts in conflict. Don't do these things. One, I'll wait for him or her to apologize. I won't be the first to give in. Don't do that. You be the first to give in. Second, don't be guilty of not allowing a conflict to end. In other words, don't keep bringing it up. Once it's been discussed and you come to a resolution, let it end. Three, don't attack the person, attack the issue. And four, don't kill the conflict in its prime. In other words, don't walk out. One of Christ's primary ministries was to reconcile us to God and to one another. And conflicts are solved primarily through reconciliation. Ephesians 2, 14. So we have some guidelines on love, on differences between men and women, and how to solve conflicts. Thank you.